Well, we actually finally got a full page ad in the Post and told our side of the story, because we had like two whole pages of documented things that they had said about us that just absolutely were incorrect. And basically what happened was one of their reporters came and said he wanted to do an interview on our outreaches, especially our outreach in the inner city called St. Louis Dream Center. And we'd never really given a full interview to a reporter like that. And so we finally agreed to do it, and then they just kept wanting to get into more and more and more and more and more and more and more. And then another one of the reporters got involved in it, and she seemed to kind of have a personal agenda. And to be honest with you, when the stories first came out, I was absolutely just flabbergasted and appalled, because they said that we were possibly under an IRS investigation, and that's just totally not true. I've never heard anything from the IRS, never have been challenged by the IRS in any way, shape, or form. And the thing that's a shame about that kind of stuff is when, even though they say possibly, they cover themselves by not making direct statements, but it still appears to everybody else like, you may be doing something wrong.
That was Joyce Meyer in an interview here on Issues Etc. several weeks back, when asked the question whether she wanted to respond to many of the things that had been written about her in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch yesterday in the Sunday edition of the paper to our readers. An apology among some of the things that the editorial board for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch is apologizing for. Well, on that IRS issue, this is what they say. According to an attorney for the ministry is in full compliance with all IRS rules. The April 18th news article reported a critic's speculation regarding an IRS investigation, but did not report the ministry's denial. So inadequate reporting in that case, of course. There are also some other details about which the St. Louis Post-Dispatch are apologizing. One of them, I think this is really pretty significant, in that 18th story from April, you may have read that all four of Joyce's children sit on the ministry board. That is simply not true, and the St. Louis Post-Dispatch is admitting to misreporting that. According to the ministry, only two of Meyer's children currently serve on the ministry's board. Four family members currently on the board do not constitute a majority of the board, as reported in the April 18th story. I want to know, we had a call before the break from Norm, who says, look, his big concern is the extravagant lifestyle. I want to know, in the next 20 minutes, is Joyce Meyer Ministries now exonerated with you? Does this apology from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch show that it was all simply trumped up, made up, and otherwise not worth reading? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Now, Norm raised the issue of monetary success and an extravagant lifestyle. Okay, my response to that is kind of yes and no. First of all, I think anyone needs to be conscious of the fact, especially ministers of the gospel. And I think Joyce Meyer would probably call herself a minister of the gospel. I wouldn't necessarily call her that, but she would call herself that. Need to be conscious of the fact that there's always the potential for a misimpression if one lives an extravagant lifestyle, about what your priorities are, about what you're in it for, all of those kind of things. But so is there a possibility that the message that you preach might be in some way hampered by the lifestyle you live, if it's extravagant or just kind of over the top? Yes, there is. But with that said, I don't think we can scripturally make any definitive statements about whether or not someone in Joyce's position should be wealthy or not. We might say it is imprudent of her to do this. We might say that her theological basis for taking the salary she does has no scriptural foundation. I think I'd be willing to say both of those things. But there is no thus saith the Lord. If you have a prominent and successful ministry, you can't be rich. Now, for those of us who are not rich, we look in and we say, golly, it just doesn't look right to me. Although Joyce might say, look, $1 million a year salary and then maybe $250,000 a year salary. Compare that to other people, what a CEO makes. Compare that with what an athlete makes. Compare that with some other media personality, what they make. It's pretty modest by comparison. What about the rest of you? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Kurt is up next, calling from his car. Kurt, welcome.
Hi, Pastor Todd. I've been following the Joyce Meyer story, listening on your program, reading the Post-Dispatch, and also listening to other radio shows. I did hear press secretary or the spokesman for Joyce Meyer Ministries interviewed on another radio station, and I called in, and one of my questions was regarding whether Joyce Meyer's Ministries was a member of the Evangelical Financial Accountability Organization. And I didn't know much about it, but I'd heard that Billy Graham's organization was a member, and that this was maybe started by Larry Burkett. And I suggested that, you know, this might be a good way for Joyce Meyer Ministries to shield themselves from criticism if in fact, you know, this organization were to set guidelines and provide some sort of accountability and overview. I didn't think I got a very forthcoming response. The gentleman said that he didn't really know much about it, and that frankly, a couple years ago he said Joyce Meyer's Ministries was small potatoes, and that you know, it wasn't a big enough ministry to join, and that it cost thousands of dollars to join. And I later looked it up on the web, and I saw about 1,100 ministries that submit their financial statements and the way they do their work, and they are members of this Evangelical Financial Accountability Association. And it seemed to me to be a really good way to shield your ministry from criticism and also provide another level of competent oversight. And so that's a little bit on the negative side. On the positive side, I was a tent maker missionary in Riga, Latvia for 4 years, and Joyce Meyer Ministries supports one of the most wonderful ministries, Christian organizations in Riga, Latvia. And I don't know how she did it, but it's a Christian organization that helps street children, kids that have alcoholic parents and are kind of left on the street. And so I will say that in Joyce Meyer's defense, I've heard that the money that she gives away is given to very good organizations, Christian organizations.
I have heard the same thing, Kurt, and thank you very much for your thoughts on that. I've heard the same thing. I heard that, and I think I have no reason not to believe this, that Joyce Meyer Ministries is very careful about where they put their money abroad, not only that it's actually being used for what it's saying it's being used, but they're very careful about this. I have no reason to believe otherwise at all, and I've heard about exactly that ministry, and believe me, that is a tremendous need over there in the former Soviet Union. There are a lot of kids whose parents are at home drunk, and these kids are literally fending for themselves out in the street. And as far as doing civil good there, I don't know that anybody said that Joyce Meyer Ministries doesn't do civil good. I mean, there are some of these characters who literally have shell corporations for the money, and they say we're doing good, and what it's doing is it's just coming right back around to home. There's no evidence for that in Joyce Meyer's organization whatsoever. And I don't think you necessarily have to be one of the big fish in order to say, yeah, we will join an accountability organization like Billy Graham or any other ministry would. I mean, who knows what Billy Graham makes? Billy Graham might make $1 million a year. I don't know. Maybe he does. There is something in Scripture about appearing blameless in the eyes of outsiders, insofar as we can. We're always going to be on the wrong side of the world's view of us as Christians, but appearing blameless, giving the world no reason to blame us. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Tim's up next, calling from his car.
Yeah, Todd, you were talking about whether or not Christians should allow their kids to do all these things that the world, you know, permits their kids to do. And I just want to say that I think that, you know, there may be an exception where somebody has success with protecting their kids from these type things. But overall, I think it's very futile. I think in the world that we're living, I think it's so perverse and evil. I mean, I think if you look to People magazine or actors and actresses and sports heroes and music heroes, you know, it's all so vile. The styles nowadays, if you go down to Target or Kmart, Sears, anywhere, all these girls got these low hip plug and things on, you know. I mean, that's all they sell you nowadays. And I just think it's so much of it, and it's constantly brainwashing the kids, even desensitizing adults to this, that we don't even see how evil this place really is. And I think it's just like even with the grace of the Lord to save us from our own sins, I think our only chance to save the next generation is also from the totally up upon the grace of the Lord. Who he saves, he saves. And I think all we can hope and pray for is that he comes and saves us from this. Because I think the styles, the way they promote dating now, these kids that are 12 and 13 years old think they're ready to date, you know, and that they're a lot more grown up than they are. And again, everything's about, you know, making out and money and success and you know, and just everything is taking people away from the Lord.
Tim, thank you very much. Well, I think it goes without saying it, but we have to say it anyway, and that is that if it were not for God's abiding and abundant grace over all of us, none of us could be parents, protect our children, or keep, as Luther says, a stick of straw in the house. We must depend upon God to ultimately protect our children. The question I'm asking is, as those who have been parents, who have been given the task by God to oversee these children for as long as we oversee them, can we responsibly say, yeah, I mean, you're a good kid. You got good grades. Go ahead. Daytona Beach awaits. 505-7850-1-800-730-2727. DB calls from his car. DB, welcome.
Yeah, the comment I had on the this whole Joyce Meyer thing is that I've been thinking about it. I think I necessarily want to assume the worst about the ministry because I disagree with their perspectives. I think that she's a word faith teacher. But that doesn't necessarily mean that she's going to be inappropriate with the funds they have. And so I think it's really very difficult for us to judge a ministry based on simply how much money the pastor makes, because I don't know where you draw the line, biblically speaking. I think we need to always evaluate a ministry or church based on its doctrine, its teaching, what it does with the, you know, with the scripture and how it teaches and preaches that scripture. If a ministry is centered on the ministry should always be judged by its orthodoxy, by how it proclaims the cross. And then I think these other issues are peripheral. I think they'll fall in line most of the time with the church that is abiding to the scripture. So that's my whole comment.
DB, good thoughts. I think that's absolutely right, which is the reason when we talked with Joyce Meyer a couple of weeks ago, we did give her an opportunity to respond to the St. Louis Post-Dispatch reporting, but then immediately spent the rest of the time talking with her about her theology. I have no reason to believe that she isn't honest in her financial dealings. And if there's no evidence to the contrary, and of course she will be open to scrutiny. Shouldn't we expect scrutiny for someone who has suddenly met with success and whose organization up to this point has been a little bit closed and secretive and in-house? Well, there's going to be some scrutiny. But after the scrutiny is conducted, we say, well, look, they appear to be honest. What about the rest of you? 505-7850-1-800-730-2727. I think that kind of puts a cap on what Norm had to say at the beginning of when he called before the break, and that was, look, there's always a potential for scandal when it comes, and I'm talking not scandal in the sense of Joyce Meyer engaged in scandal, but people looking in from the outside saying, it just doesn't seem right to be flying around in a jet free. It just doesn't seem right to be living in a house free. I'd like to have a private jet take me to the Issues Etc. Reformation tours, but I am stuck in a van with Jeff for 6 hours at a stretch. And we got some places to go in the next couple of months. We've got to go to Wichita and out in Topeka and Kansas City and out to Los Angeles and San Francisco. And that's going to cost somebody some money, and we're not going to be able to do it free. And it won't be a private jet either. Believe me, we'll be flying coach. I don't know which I dread more, sitting next to Jeff in a van for 6 hours or sitting next to him in a plane, because those seats are actually closer together for 6 hours. 505-7850-1-800-730-2727. Real quick before we go to the phones, think about this, parents, and letting your kids go on these trips. Question this way. What did everybody say about the mother of the alleged victim of Michael Jackson? What did they all say about this woman, the accuser? Irresponsible mother, put her child in harm's way, even if Michael Jackson wasn't a child molester, knowing what she accused him of, knowing what she knew, all along, she continued to let her child be in harm's way in Michael Jackson's bedroom and elsewhere. And so everyone rightly is saying, she a bad mom. Not acting as a parent should. I agree with that completely. I don't see any big difference between that and putting your child in harm, a child in harm's way. Michael Jackson won't be down at Daytona Beach trying to fondle your children. No. 4,000 young men will be. Or young women. And Michael Jackson might have given that boy some wine to drink. Guarantee there's going to be a lot of beer and wine and everything else down at Daytona Beach. Bad parents. Walt calls from his car. Walt, welcome.
Yes, Pastor. My comment was that judging a ministry or even an individual pastor by their prosperity or how well they seem to be doing in life is a very tricky thing, because there could be mismanagement there, or it could just be that they are a blessed person. I've had my son-in-law, someone gave him almost a brand new car the other day, and now he's driving that. That would be easy to, for people to point the finger at him and say, well, you know, I don't think he makes that much. Where did he get that? Should he give the car back? Should he not accept it? I go to a Word of Faith church of about 400. It's not a large church. My pastor has driven in the last couple of years a BMW and a Corvette, but that is because he's a car buff. He buys them used and he restores them. Should he not do that because someone might see him driving a BMW? I think we seem to have this idea that pastors are supposed to go around with holes in their shoes and moth-eaten clothes to show their piety. And, you know, that also, you know, who wants to listen to someone who, you know, I mean, you're preaching to people who maybe are poor, who have no hope, who want to think there's something better, and, you know, they want to know that God cares for them. Well, if you're being preached to by someone who drives an old raggedy, rusted-out bucket and has holes in their clothes, or do they believe that God is taking care of this pastor that's preaching the message too? I mean, it's a tricky subject, and I try not to judge people on the basis of what they drive or what they look like. Sometimes God just blesses people. I think it gives God pleasure to see his children prosperous.
Well, you had me almost up until the very end, and I agree with you up until the point of saying, I agree with you when you say, look, this is not something that we can say, thus saith the Lord, on how much should a pastor make, what should they drive, how should they dress. There's no thus saith the Lord here. What are we guided by? Prudence, reason, a sense of scale. I am a very, very wealthy man in comparison to a Nigerian missionary. I'm like a king in comparison to this guy. Or missionaries in almost any place in the rest of the world. Or pastors who are pastoring numerous churches in China. I'm fabulously wealthy by comparison, even though I'm completely and utterly average in the United States. So there's a sense of scale there as well. And you had me up until the point where you said, well, look, if you're trying to preach to people that there's something better, the preacher ought to be prosperous, or he ought to at least appear to be prosperous. What the preacher has to offer the poor, the middle class, and the rich that is better is not prosperity, not worldly prosperity, but in fact, the undeserved favor of God for Christ's sake and the cross of Jesus Christ. That's what he has to offer that's better. Now, he ought to adorn himself in every way with that, however he dresses. However he dresses. You guys could see me right now. I mean, T-shirt, jeans, and as only a 40-year-old balding man can pull off, socks and flip-flops. My wife laughs at me every time I walk out of the house like this. I mean, someone might look at me and say, if you judge the ministry by what the man wears, if the clothes make the ministry, that's a serious problem, Walt. What makes the ministry? The Word. The Word. I think you would do well to hear from our previous caller, DB, who says, we don't judge the prosperity or the goodness or the badness of the ministry based upon the success of the pastor, but upon what they preach. And there's a lot we could talk about with Joyce Meyer Ministries concerning what she preaches without ever touching upon how much she makes or how much money is produced by the ministry. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. So if it doesn't work one way, if we shouldn't criticize them for their wealth, we also should not think them especially blessed of God for their wealth. While this may be a temporal blessing that God has poured out upon them, it might also be, as in the case of some CEOs, not the blessing of God, but their own, sometimes their own ingeniousness, their own cleverness, or their own illegal activities might also be a curse. I don't think we can find a scripture where it says more money equals more blessing from God. In fact, I don't know, not really sure, but I think Jesus did have something to say about blessed are the poor. And I think he would equally say blessed are the rich, who are still poor in spirit and receive everything from the merciful hand of God for Christ's sake. That's where the blessing lies, not in what we have or don't have. Now, does this mean that a pastor should be unconscious of these kind of things? In other words, hey, look, if I want to drive a $150,000 Hummer into church every day and take up two parking spaces and take extravagant trips with my wife and live in a big palatial house, should I have no concern for how that appears to people inside and outside the church? No, I should have every concern for it. And how does Paul deal with that issue in the New Testament? If it causes my brother to stumble, there is always concern for the weaker brother, the person whose faith, whose trust in Jesus may be compromised by something I do or I don't do. And by the way, Walt, God can work through a man who's got holes in his shoes. He can work through a man who has no shoes. Otherwise, those poor Nigerian missionaries or everywhere else in the world that they are who don't have two dimes to rub together, and when they do, that's how much they get paid for the week. Their message must not be much either. We do not judge the value of the message of the cross by the wealth of the person who preaches it. When we come back from this break, we're going to be talking for about 25 minutes with Dr. Brad Stetson. He's a lecturer in American politics at Azusa Pacific University and in rhetoric at Chapman University. He has co-authored a new book titled The Truth About Tolerance. We'll talk about what tolerance is and isn't for the next 25 minutes. Then Uwe Simonetto joins us, our religion roundup. We'll talk, among other things, about the weekend protests over gay marriage in Spain, of all places, and what happened to the European Constitution. Why did France and the Netherlands decide to opt out of what looked like a very promising document for the unification of Europe? That's Uwe Simonetto coming up in about 25 minutes. In the last half hour of the program, Brian Godawa joins us. We're going to get some movie reviews. Summer is upon us. The movies are out. We'll find out what worldviews you will find both in the theater and at home on your rentals. Stay tuned.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Listen to this prayer from Martin Luther. Dear Lord, you know that I cannot come before you on account of my own self, my presumption, my worthiness. I would not even know how I might begin to pray. Nevertheless, I do come before you because you have commanded it and you earnestly encourage that we should call upon you. That is but one part of but one prayer in our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for June, a Lutheran Book of Prayer. The book is $8.99 plus shipping and handling. For this devotional resource, call 1-800-325-3040 and ask for a Lutheran Book of Prayer, the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for June, 1-800-325-3040. For more information on the book, go to our website, issuesetc.org. Right there on the homepage, you'll find a Lutheran Book of Prayer, the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for June.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Terry Phillips, sitting in for Bob Dittmer. A national pro-life organization wants to unplug California's fledgling and expensive embryonic stem cell research industry by establishing constitutional rights virtually from conception. Josh Montes has the story.
Martin Palmer is an attorney for the advancement of preborn children. He's filing a lawsuit on behalf of all the frozen embryos that are targeted to be experimented on at the California Institute for Regenerative Medicine.
The purpose of the lawsuit is to support the president and to stand for the truth that the human embryo is an equal member of the community of man.
If the lawsuit is successful, it will give constitutional rights to the unborn, like equal protection. Jim Sedlak is with the American Life League.
This kind of a lawsuit is aimed specifically at what we're after, and that is establishing the personhood of the child at fertilization.
They really have cut out for themselves a difficult row to hoe.
Julie Parton is with Focus on the Family. She applauds the efforts of the advancement of preborn children and would like to see a stop to embryonic stem cell research. But she thinks they're going to have a hard time convincing the courts that embryos are children.
They confuse the idea that an embryo, because it is so small, they have a hard time comprehending that it is valuable. It's going to be, I think, a real difficult legal process here. These are very brave folks taking this on.
If the lawsuit does establish the personhood of embryos, it's possible it would indirectly discourage other states from considering embryonic stem cell research. For Family News and Focus, I'm Josh Montes.
Last November, California voters okayed $3 billion for embryonic stem cell research in the state, which is far and away the most aggressive program to date. For Family News and Focus, I'm Terry Phillips.
Have you tried and failed to live a purpose-driven life? Do your attempts to live a life that is pleasing to God fall so far short that you'd rather stay home from church? Then join Christ Our Savior Lutheran Church in Freeburg, where the focus isn't on you, but on Christ, who was made sin for us, that we might become the righteousness of God in Him. Christ Our Savior Lutheran Church is located at 612 North State Street in Freeburg. Their phone number, 618-539-5664.
Don't let the title fool you. You don't have to be Lutheran to benefit from our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June. It's titled The Lutheran Book of Prayer. It's published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Or you can find out more about the Lutheran Book of Prayer on our website, issuesetc.org. The Lutheran Book of Prayer costs $8.99 plus shipping and handling. 1-800-325-3040.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. here halfway during the program. In just a minute, Dr. Brad Stetson will join us to talk about tolerance. He's co-author of a new book titled The Truth About Tolerance. Tolerance is a term, you know what I've noted, while it used to be a term that was well accepted by Christians, with the rise of false tolerance, Christians seem to be engaging in some type of a backlash where tolerance has become a dirty word. Let's always remember that there is such a thing, and I think it's grounded in a Christian worldview as true tolerance. And when we talk about the false tolerance of the culture, and sometimes as it finds its way into the church, let's just put our quotation marks, our little air quotes around that word tolerance to indicate that we're not talking about the kind of tolerance that a Christian worldview would have us hold. So we'll talk about tolerance here in just a few minutes on Issues Etc. Then we're going to spend some time talking with Dr. Uwe Simonetto. He joins us to discuss the weekend protests over gay marriage in Madrid, Spain, and also whatever happened to Europe's United Constitution in the last couple weeks. After that religion roundup, Brian Godawa joins us. Some movie reviews. I love doing movie reviews because I like going to see movies. I like talking about the worldview that is portrayed in the movies that we watch. We'll be talking about what's on the big screen, what's on the small screen as well with Brian Godawa coming up in the last half hour of Issues Etc. Feel free to join us, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, is a place where men are being prepared for the pastoral ministry, and they're being prepared to practice in their ministry, in their life, in their relationship with the world, with competing worldviews, with the ideas of our culture and the ideas that prevail in the church, true tolerance. That is, to hold firmly to what they believe without compromise, to openly disagree with competing truths, I put that in quote, and yet to be tolerant of those who hold those views. You see, there's a difference between tolerating ideas and tolerating those who hold those ideas. At Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, they're being fully informed in the classroom as they prepare for the pastoral ministry about what ideas prevail in the world and in the church and how to respond to them in a thoroughly scriptural way with Christian tolerance. For more information about Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, go to our website. You will find a picture of Kramer Chapel, the famous chapel at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, and next to it, a link for more information about Concordia Theological Seminary. By the way, I'm going to be up there this weekend, I believe, on Friday night and Saturday for their Christ Academy 2005. And I'm just going to be lecturing there for 4 hours, I believe, on Saturday to a group of those high school-aged men. Just one of the things offered by Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. This is a hard lesson to learn and a hard lesson to teach, especially today when the T word, tolerance, is so misused, or as our guest here in this next 25 minutes says, so twisted. Well, we all know what twisted tolerance looks like. In a world of religious pluralism, twisted tolerance looks like affirming the truth of everyone's religious beliefs. We all know what twisted tolerance looks like when it comes to a society that is morally relativistic. That means affirming what everyone does and what everyone thinks is right and thinks is wrong without any discernment, without any critique. And we know what it looks like with the general subject of truth, this twisted tolerance. We end up with a marketplace of truths that while they all compete, they all stand on equal footing. And no one, according to twisted tolerance, is able to say to anyone else, you're wrong. You know, we had that conversation not too long ago with Bishop John Shelby Spong. And you heard in spades what tolerance, what the new tolerance sounds like. Although he and I completely disagreed in every way, I could not get him to say that he disagreed with me. I wasn't exactly trying to get him to say that he disagreed with me, but it would have been nice given the fact that he seemed to affirm everything I believe when it's evident from his writings he doesn't. Now, how could he do it? How could he say after I laid out the teaching of sin and grace for Bishop Spong, how could he say, well, I'm not going to tell you you're wrong? There's one way that he was able to do that. And he is perhaps the most consistent postmodern practitioner of tolerance that I have ever come across in 6 years doing this program, either what I've read or who I've talked to. He wouldn't tell me I'm wrong because he couldn't. In the world of twisted tolerance, you can't tell anyone that they're wrong. Now, you won't tell them they're right, necessarily, if you disagree with them, but you see, that's really at the heart of this twisted tolerance. You're not really allowed to disagree. We'll be talking about tolerance. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727 with Dr. Brad Stetson. He's a lecturer in American politics at Azusa Pacific University and in rhetoric at Chapman University. Now, we're going to have to move him around a little bit because of a scheduling conflict. So we'll take up our conversation with Uwe Simonetto, our religion roundup, here for the next few minutes of the program. Uwe is a regular guest. He joins us to talk about the weekend protests in Madrid, Spain, over gay marriage and a few other issues he's been writing on lately. Uwe, welcome back to Issues, Etc. Uwe, what's going on in Madrid over gay marriage, the nature of these protests? What can you tell us?
Well, the nature of the protest is that Orthodox Christians are hitting back against something that is going on in Spain that you have to look at from a historical context. The left has taken over Spain, especially after the last year's disaster, the terrorist attack. And the problem with Spain is the same problem that you have with many country, many Catholic countries. Italy is another one, where you know you experience a pendulum swing. Spain used to be the most Catholic country in all of Europe, the most Christian country in terms of practice, and of course now they're swinging back the in the other extreme. By trying to make everything that the church stood for, undo everything the church stood for, including, of course, morality, and it doesn't seem to work out all that well for the government, because it seems that the Spaniards, when they voted in the socialist government last year after the terrorist attack, did not do so simply to undo their Christian past. They did so, of course, primarily out of fear of further involvement in the Iraq War.
Uwe, were you surprised by the turnout at this protest, this demonstration? We're talking about hundreds of thousands, including, according to the Associated Press, 20 Roman Catholic bishops there in Madrid.
Yeah, no, I wasn't surprised at the turnout at all. First of all, let's make this one thing very clear. The Catholic Church, and not only the Catholic Church, we'll get to that in a minute, but the Catholic Church, especially under the leadership of Cardinal Ratzinger now, Pope Benedict XVI, has made it very, very clear that they will be striking back against this total secularization and anti-Christian behavior. And they seem to be striking a chord within Spain. It doesn't, evidently, there are still more believing Christians about than people suspected after the election results. You see, people vote one way, which might surprise some people, but they do not do this for necessarily for reasons dealing with having to do with religious matters. You know.
Is it safe to say that the electorate there in Spain, when they ousted the previous government and installed Socialist Prime Minister Zapatero, didn't know what they were getting into when it came to issues like gay marriage?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, but that is a general European phenomenon. I mean, you know, people voted in Germany, the Schröder-Fischer government, and for all sorts of reasons, and then suddenly found themselves in the clutches of these horrendous ideologues, you see.
All right, let's talk a bit about the involvement of the Roman Catholic Church there in Spain. You mentioned that at one time Spain was the most Roman Catholic nation in all of Europe. Are Roman Catholics now in a minority? Is that how this came about?
Well, Roman Catholics are simply, numerically, obviously, still in the majority. But the Roman Catholics have a lot of catching up to do. Therefore, they're going overboard with this. It's sort of, you know, it's a very strange thing. It's a sort of odd, quote, liberation, unquote, with unforeseen and unintended results. It is my impression, I mean, when I'm in Europe, I live just north of the Spanish border, just 2.5 hours drive or something like that. And I always feel that Spain is still very much a Christian country and a Catholic country, and the church is still very, very much present. But on the other hand, you also have in Spain a development. You know, you have abortion rates are going up. You have a very, very active homosexual community, much more so than in many other countries, which I think is simply a pendulum swing. And I don't think this is one thing that I always try to warn my American friends about when they look at Europe. Don't take pendulum swings as signs of a permanent shift in basic beliefs. I think that we're not quite there yet.
Well, the particular piece of law that is under consideration there and being pushed by the socialist government in Spain is expected to be voted on next week. According to the AP, opinion polls indicate a majority of Spaniards support the bill. Will gay marriage and the attendant gay adoption be legal in Spain in the next couple of weeks, Uwe?
Probably. I hope not, but probably.
What will that mean when it comes, and this is where our next subject goes, Uwe, to the relationship of Spain to the rest of the countries in the European Union? Do they join the ranks of countries who are already allowing this? What is that issue like for greater Europe?
Well, the issue, it is a major issue for greater Europe. And well, first of all, you don't have gay marriage rights in that sense, for example, in Germany. And you don't really have them in France. You have the so-called, what's called PACs, which means that, you know, you have laws governing the relationships between same-sex unions, but they are not equal to marriage. What will it mean? I think it will simply just show up in the eyes of many Europeans of all sorts of persuasion, the depravity to which modernity has brought us, and which is very heavily influencing an undercurrent of debate within European Union, European societies, which you will not hear over here and can't hear over here unless you are actually involved in it immediately. It's when you sit down with people over dinner privately and discuss these things, then you will find echoes of what you are hearing over here, and probably even discussed much more profoundly. I mean, there is a lot of fear going on over over this depravity to which we have sunk. Where this is going to lead, God only knows. I just suspect that once this has gone that way, you will eventually, within a longer time frame, have a pendulum swing back, and we're seeing some of this in some countries, chiefly in France, where the pendulum has swung in the wrong direction a long time ago, which was in fact the in the vanguard of this anti-Christian movement, and of course you see a lot of that going on in Germany. Just wait for the next elections in Germany, and you might see that a lot of that can draw a lot of conclusions from that.
Do you expect Pope Benedict XVI to make any kind of statement should gay marriage and gay adoption become legal in Spain?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, he will make it very, very clear. Look, the guy gave himself the name Benedict because Benedict is the patron saint of Europe. He, as his predecessor, is dedicated to the re-evangelization of Europe. And in his tow, as it were, you now already see have a lot of Protestant leaders, including Lutherans, who say, well, it's high time we do something about this. He is not going to wink at the Spaniards and say, oh, you nice little sweet Spaniards, have a little bit of fun until we come back. He is going to be very, very tough on that.
You have also written recently, near the end of last month, about the Constitution for a United Europe. Before we get into the details of what happened there, Uwe, many Christians in America, I am not among them, but many Christians in America are extremely wary of the UE, of a United Europe. They think it has something to do with biblical prophecy. They think it must have some sort of sinister roots and a sinister result. How would you respond to Christians who are wary of what we've called already the Greater Europe?
Yeah, well, that's a very strange reading of Scripture, of course. I respond to that very simply with this. I've been writing a lot about this, indeed. The Greater Europe, or the European unification process, was based on the Christian concept of reconciliation, chiefly between Germany and France and surrounding countries. That is what it's all about. Then, as a result of the 1960s and the secularization of the 1960s, and an enormous amount of hubris in the growing Europe, this beautiful communion of nations grew into a monster run by a monstrous bureaucracy. Politicians without any conscience very often. I mean, like these people who wrote this constitution without any reference to the one thing that united all Europeans, which was our common Christian history, it's a different matter. The fear that American Christians might, some American Christians might have, that this is a sort of biblical development here, that we're now seeing here the forces of evil marching in our direction. I mean, you just see God's humor when those clowns like Giscard d'Estaing try to write a constitution without any mention of God, and the Germans, who have God in their constitution, the very first sentence, agree to it. Then the very nation that actually started the secularization, namely France, voted it down. I think this is a wonderful example of God's sense of irony. And a lot of people in Europe that I've discussed this with are thinking along those lines. They say, well, look, isn't it absolutely laughable? Most of us, I am a committed European. I am German. I am closely connected with France and by marriage with England. I'm very committed to European unification process, but not a European, a Europe run by idiotic bureaucrats who determine, who try to impose the bent of bananas on the entire continent, for example, which is indeed what these guys are doing, spending hundreds of millions of dollars on something idiotic like that. That is where the problem lies. And the other thing is, Europe will not. Europe of 25 nations is already rather big. It will not include Turkey. I doubt this very much. And the Dutch, in particular, but also the French and the Germans, find the notion that Turkey and an Islamic state be part of a continent based on Christianity, even though they've forgotten some of their Christian past, is absolutely horrendous. So, and then, of course, neighboring Iraq and Syria and all these countries. I mean, so why not include Outer Mongolia and by all means, Japan?
So where do you think the boundaries of a united Europe ought to fall? And where do you think they will eventually fall? Because there are an awful lot of applicants and, at this point, relatively few members, and then a few abstainers, most notably, of course, Switzerland, sitting right there in the center of the subcontinent. Where do you think it will eventually fall?
Well, I suspect, and I'm not the only one, I think that is a general consensus among people who are involved in this process, I suspect you will have an inner core of Europe that may consist of the original six, which is France, Germany, Benelux states, and Italy, plus some other countries, including, obviously, Poland. You can't exclude a Christian country like Poland, or Austria and Hungary. This would be the inner core. You will have a development towards some form of either confederation, which I believe is going to happen, or even a federation.
Okay.
Then you have an outer core, an outer circle, still part of the European Union, who are enjoying economic and other privileges, but who will not be as closely integrated with the rest of us than they anticipated. And I think the border will be between Greece and Bulgaria on the European side, and Turkey on the other, with special privileges, economic and other privileges for Turkey. And of course, the Soviet Union, Russia will not be part of it. The question of whether the Ukraine will or will not is very open, and not so much because the Ukrainians should not be part, but you have in the eastern Ukraine huge Russian majorities that are still part of Ukraine but are actually Russians, And this will be this is not doable. It will not. This would destroy the European Union.
We have only about a minute here before we go to this break, Uwe. Between now and the last time we talked to you, Newsweek had a story that you say really shows the ignorance, indifference, incompetence, ideology, and insufficient resources of reporting on religious issues. Of course, Newsweek reported about the flushing of a Quran down the toilet at a U.S. Detention center, and that sparked all sorts of riots in Islamic countries. With only about a minute here, your thoughts on what happened there?
Well, the thought is, you know, this is a Pavlovian knee-jerk sort of a reaction. You knock your own country, and they never reflect on the reactions to such reports in the countries, because they themselves are, have no commitment to their own religion, so therefore they don't expect that others will have a commitment to theirs, which is where it is so important that future journalists have to learn to take religion into account for their own research, and therefore they must know about this. It goes even further. Same thing can be said, of course, to these guerrillas down at Guantanamo who do silly stuff with the Korans. That is also true. I mean, the military are just as responsible for that, because you do, whilst the Koran is not my holy book, I still have to respect it as the holy book of people who are under my care as prisoners or whatever. You see, so I mean, we are living in a situation here where really the role of religion in society, in world affairs, in military affairs, in conflicts, is not duly recognized, because people are too ignorant about that.
And with only 30 seconds, Uwe, someone might say, well, what about the Christian colleges, Christian universities, where journalism is being taught? Does it fare any better there? Are they better prepared?
Alas, not. I mean, you know, I've been trying to sell this program to some Christian colleges, and for the time being, I'm not doing too well. Some are doing okay, Hillsdale College, I think the Concordia system will, but it is still, they don't see it. They still have blinders on. They don't see that religion is very much a driving force in world affairs, and therefore, irrespective of your personal religious commitment, has to be taught.
Uwe Simonetto is an international journalist, joins us regularly for our Religion Roundup. Uwe, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
When we come back from this break, we're going to be talking with Brian Gidawa. I'm a big movie buff. Maybe you are as well. We're going to talk about the movies that are on the big screen and the little screen and the world views that we find therein. Brian is next in the third hour of Issues, Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.